Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Anish Chagpar, Susan Higgins, and Stephen Gore. I'm Bruce Barber. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu. And if you're interested in listening to past editions, all of the shows are posted on the Yale Cancer Center website at yalecancercenter.org. This week, Dr. Stephen Gore will be speaking with Dr. Scott Huntington. Dr. Gore is Director of Hematological Malignancies at Smilow Cancer Hospital and an expert on myelodysplastic syndromes. Dr. Huntington is an assistant professor of medicine at Yale School of Medicine, and he joins Dr. Gore for a conversation about hematological malignancies.
Scott, you treat lymphoma. What's lymphoma?
Yeah, so lymphoma is actually the most common blood cancer. And blood cancer as a whole is actually relatively rare. So about 10% of all cancers are blood cancers. And lymphomas make up the majority in terms of numbers. But lymphoma represents a disease arising from the lymph nodes. And in total, there's almost 60 different types of lymphoma. So it's a rather basket diagnosis. And we're learning more each and every year about subdivision within lymphomas and how we actually recognize patients have different lymphomas that need different treatment. So it's a really fascinating field that's moving really dramatically to improve patient outcomes and diagnosis.
Now, does lymphoma include Hodgkin's disease? Is that a lymphoma?
Yeah, so you can parse lymphomas in a number of different ways. One is Hodgkin's lymphoma versus non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Non-Hodgkin lymphoma is more common. That's typically a disease of the aging, whereas Hodgkin lymphoma has two distributions, one in the early phase where people are typically in the late adolescent and early adulthood, and then again towards the 60s. That's about 8,500 cases in the United States each year in terms of Hodgkin lymphoma. Non-Hodgkin lymphoma are much more common. We're talking about closer to 70, 80,000 cases in the United States each year.
Wow. So 70 or 80,000 and there's 60 types or so, huh?
That's true. Yeah, that's true. So it's a really, although I'm a specialist in lymphoma, each day is very different in clinic where I have different ages and certainly different histologies and diagnoses that really keep my day varied, certainly in the clinic.
And do you organize your days that way? Like today is my this kind of lymphoma, and tomorrow's my that kind of lymphoma day?
Not quite yet, but certainly we could get there.
Yeah. So how do you, I mean, it seems really complicated to have to keep track of that many different diseases. I mean, we train in oncology, and there's lots of different cancers, and, you know, I can't keep track of all of those. And now here you are theoretically treating one kind of cancer, but it's really so many.
Yeah. So I think as we learn more about cancers in general, that we're further subclassifying lots of cancers and kind of the personalized medicine approach of treating patients with cancers. In terms of lymphoma, although there are 60 different types, how in my mind I classify things are whether they're aggressive or whether they're more on the indolent or slow-growing side. And so even though we have 60, we can further kind of classify those patients in terms of the presentation, how patients present with these illnesses, and then also how we might be to treat them based on whether these are aggressive diseases or more indolent processes.
Why is it important to differentiate between those that are more aggressive and those that are more slow-growing or indolent, as you put it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So in terms of aggressive lymphomas, what makes them aggressive? And typically, it's that these cause patient symptoms over weeks to months. So patients present to their provider with, say, fever or chills or night sweats or rapidly enlarging lumps or lymph nodes. And when a diagnosis is made, that typically would show a histology where the cells are replicating and this is an aggressive disease. Conversely, more indolent processes typically progress over months to years, and typically patients are asymptomatic when they're diagnosed. And so a patient may present to their primary care doctor and have routine blood work or routine exam and have a slightly abnormal finding, which could lead to diagnosis. In aggressive versus indolent, not only clinically, has an importance, but actually in terms of treatment. And so aggressive lymphomas actually are quite sensitive to our treatment. So if we give chemotherapy, we are hoping that we're actually going to cure the majority of patients with aggressive lymphomas. Whereas patients that have the more indolent process, we actually may just observe these patients over time because they may either never become symptomatic or they may be able to live quite well with their disease for a number of years before needing treatment. And so although there are 60 subclassifications of lymphoma, we can really focus focus on whether they're aggressive that require more intensive treatment versus the more indolent that could really be potentially watched and surveyed very closely.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it seems to me if I were a patient and I found a lump or my doctor found a lump and you told me it was cancer, but we're just going to watch it, I'm not sure I'd really go for that. I mean, I want that thing out of there. Why can't you just, like, go in there and cut it out or blast it out? Or I don't want to, like, be watching cancer. What's that about?
Yeah, so an indolent process or indolent lymphoma can really be varied in itself, whether it's more extensive, whether a patient has only one location or multiple locations. And if it is only one location, sometimes surgery or blasting it with radiation, as you may call, can actually lead to very good outcomes. But if lymphoma in an indolent process is more on the systemic side, that patients have multiple regions, what we found over time that if we give treatment right away, patients can certainly have some side effects from the treatment, and what we find over time is that these lymphomas, the indolent lymphomas, typically come back with treatment. Whereas if we wait for patients, and actually it's not so much waiting, but actually surveying patients. So if a patient has an indolent disease, an indolent lymphoma, we watch them very closely, and over time, if we detect symptoms, we start treatment. And it seems like that's active surveillance with treatment when times of symptoms arise seems to be the best way of treating indolent processes and in lymphomas.
So the outcomes aren't better if you treat early?
That is exactly right, yes. Huh.
And why aren't those patients easily cured? Like, what's up with that?
Yeah, so how I think of it is an indolent lymphoma has many cancer cells that are quite indolent or are basically dormant, and so they're not replicating. And so when I give chemotherapy to these patients, they get rid of the replicating portion, but there's plenty of cells that are basically dormant and resistant to active chemotherapy. When you take that to the aggressive lymphoma, such like diffuse large B-cell or Burkitt's, where really all the lymphoma cells are replicating quite quickly, our chemotherapy can eradicate all of that. And so it really, the pathophysiology and the basis of these lymphomas does explain some of the activity of how our chemotherapies work and whether a patient can be cured or whether they can be rendered in a very good remission that can last years potentially and be treated kind of over time. So indolent processes we typically try to convert into a more chronic disease where patients really hopefully don't have a lot of symptoms from the disease and also don't have a lot of symptoms from our treatment. That's the goal when I see a patient with indolent. Whereas the goal is very different. If someone comes with an aggressive lymphoma, my goal is to get rid of it for good and not have it come back.
Hmm. So can you walk us through what happens to a patient if they find a lump or somebody finds a lump and it is going to turn out to be lymphoma? How does that all play out?
Yeah, so many things can cause lumps or lymphadenopathy. Infections, so if someone has a viral illness, they may have a lump under their neck or throat, and it could certainly go away as part of the healing process and getting over infections. If lumps persist for weeks potentially and don't wax and wane, that may trigger that maybe this is something else besides a normal inflammatory process. And so frequently what we do is if someone has a lump is that we need a biopsy, whether it be a needle or actually more commonly an excision, actually taking that lymph node and looking at it under the microscope.
Okay. And so you sent me to some kind of procedure person who's taken out my lump, and you sent it to the lab, and I'm thinking that I just had the flu, and now you're going to tell me I have cancer, and I'm going to be mad at you. Now what happens?
Yeah, so like when we take out the lymph node, there are a number of things that go on, looking at how they look under the microscope, how their genes might be arranged, to really help us classify if this is lymphoma. If it is a lymphoma, we further classify as whether it needs treatment or not. And ways that we could do that is doing imaging. So frequently we do staging procedures where we might do a CT scan, a CAT scan, a X-ray machine, or nuclear medicine scan to really get a sense of where the lymphoma is. And depending on the stage of the disease in lymphoma, we might have slightly different treatment. Maybe it's only chemotherapy alone. Other times, if there's only limited stage, so we have only a few spots, we might do chemotherapy along with radiation for those patients.
Hmm. But there's always chemotherapy.
Typically, there is always chemotherapy that is quite effective for patients with lymphoma.
Huh, interesting. So, so I'm not, I stop being mad at you because I know you're doing the best for me, and I deal with my stages of cancer dealing grief, and I say, okay, Dr. Huntington, you can go ahead and treat me, and so you've given me chemotherapy. How long does that last for usually?
Yeah, so your classic chemotherapy for lymphoma typically lasts on the order of 4 to 6 months.
Well, that's not so bad.
And the goal of that frequently is really to get this in remission, mm-hmm. where we aren't able to detect lymphoma. And if it's an aggressive lymphoma, we're hoping that the remission stays forever, that we're curing these patients. If it is on the more indolent process, we typically know that our treatments can render disease in remission, but over time, months, years, potentially even decades, the lymphoma is likely to come back in those cases. And so the most important when I see a patient is, can I cure them with my treatment? And if I can, I'm going to do everything I can to do that. If we can't, then we have to really balance the pros and cons of our treatment, the side effects of the treatment, and also the side effects of the lymphoma. And so it's a really kind of important thing to think about patients when they come to see you is, what is our goal of our treatment?
And do you tell the patients that? Or do you tell your patients you're not going to cure them?
Yeah, I think it's a process. So when patients in particular have indolent lymphoma, then I tell them, you know, we are going to likely need to treat this at some point, but I see us treating in the future. That's the first step that we need to overcome with a provider and a patient to the idea that we may not need treatment emergently for indolent lymphomas. The second process is really getting over the idea that our treatments are going to be effective, but this is likely something that you'll be dealing with for the rest of your life. And what we're finding out as our new treatments come available is that we have so many different lines of therapy for indolent lymphomas that our goal really is to convert it into a very chronic and disease that potentially doesn't impact your quality of life significantly. So it's really moving towards minimizing toxicities of our treatment. So we have a number of newer agents that are not traditional chemotherapies, but are actually oral medications, much like you would take for, say, high blood pressure or diabetes. Our goal, hopefully, is to render lymphomas into a very, very treatable without the significant side effects.
Gotcha. And if I still am resisting this and I say, I don't know, I don't like this kind of watch and wait thing and I want to be cured, could I go somewhere else and have somebody tell me differently? I mean...
There's quite a consensus on terms of indolent versus aggressive lymphomas.
Gotcha.
There are occasionally things that we can do, like I talked about radiation in early stage disease, or these more kind of advanced approaches like allogeneic stem cell transplants that sometimes can render patients in cures. But those have significant side effects. And I think there's a wide consensus that the aggressive lymphomas, we treat aggressively. We really want to cure those patients and get them in a remission that is long-lasting. Whereas the indolent process, we're really now trying to figure out how do we minimize our treatment toxicities because these patients live very well with their disease, and it's a new process that we as both a provider and a patient help them overcome and live with their disease.
All right, so I'm counting on you to talk me through this one. But before you do, we're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more about lymphoma with our guest, Dr. Scott Huntington.
There are many obstacles to face when quitting smoking, as smoking involves the potent drug nicotine, but it's a very important lifestyle change, especially for patients undergoing cancer treatment. Quitting smoking has been shown to positively impact response to treatments, decrease the likelihood that patients will develop second malignancies, and increase rates of survival. Tobacco treatment programs are currently being offered at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as Yale Cancer Center, and at Smilow Cancer Hospital. Smilow Cancer Hospital's tobacco treatment program operates on the principles of the U.S. Public Health Service Clinical Practice Guidelines. All treatment components are evidence-based, and therefore all patients are treated with FDA-approved first-line medications for smoking cessation, as well as smoking cessation counseling that stresses appropriate coping skills. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Stephen Gore, and I'm talking with my guest, Scott Huntington, about lymphoma. So, Scott, you were before the break, we were talking about, and I was kind of teasing a little bit about the fact that there were some lymphomas where people live quite well, but they are likely not to be cured, but they can live many years. And I was imagining, as I know must happen, that there must be patients who push back on that because, you know, our society focuses so much on, I'm going to beat this cancer, I'm going to fight this cancer. But you were proposing that for some cancers and some lymphomas, really learning to live well with a cancer may be the more noble goal, or maybe the only realistic goal.
Yeah, I think that is a, it's not an easy thing to overcome, and it takes time. So when a patient comes to my office and learns that they have a lymphoma diagnosis, whether it's aggressive and we're going to treat it aggressively, or whether it's indolent where we may actually not treat it for years, it's a process of really coping and education, learning more about the disease. I think what's really encouraging is that for both aggressive lymphomas and for the indolent lymphomas, we are learning more about the disease and our treatments are getting ever better. And so for the indolent processes, minimizing the side effects of our treatments and moving more towards a non-chemotherapy approach is something that many of us are really enthusiastic about, both clinicians and patients. And so we really do have a future that is very bright in terms of the current treatment and also in the future that looks even brighter for patients that have indolent lymphomas.
And I guess one of the ways that we all learn about the newer treatments or the newer biology is by going to international meetings where this information is shared, and I guess you were recently at one, is that right?
Yeah, so we just returned from San Diego where the American Society of Hematology annual meeting was held. And this is a meeting of about 20 to 30,000 hematologists and basic scientists throughout the world that come to meet each year. And the goal is really to review and discuss the most kind of pressing and up-to-date research in blood disorders. And so there definitely were some kind of high-profile and important studies that were presented this year and will likely impact how we're going to be treating patients for the next year with lymphomas.
So what did you find exciting or what did you learn that was new that our patients might, our listeners might find interesting?
Yeah, so the two most common lymphomas, one being aggressive, is diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. The other most common lymphoma is actually an indolent lymphoma called follicular lymphoma. And there were a number of large studies that that were reported at ASH this year. In the diffuse large B-cell realm, there was a study where was comparing a therapy that's a little bit more intensive treatment to what we typically use. And this was a study that we knew was underway and had actually closed accrual a number of years back. And us as a lymphoma community were really anxiously awaiting. To some surprise, that the standard treatment, the less intensive treatment, actually had the same outcomes to the more intensive treatment, but actually had fewer side effects. And so that trial was important. It was what we call a negative study, but it reassured that what we were doing is actually kind of the current standard. And so that will likely impact how we think about patients going forward.
Of course, it's kind of disappointing if you felt that the standard must have been having some failings or shortcomings, or you wouldn't have tried to make it better. And then the way you tried to make it better turned out not to.
Yeah, no,
that's kind of disappointing in some ways, right?
It is disappointing. I would say that the outcomes for the standard treatment were actually quite good. This typical treatment called CHOP or R-CHOP, which has been a standard for a number of years, has bested other treatments in the past. And so historically, this is a really good treatment that is generally well tolerated. And it doesn't mean that we're not going to try to make it better. And so there are other trials going on currently trying to, again, advance the needle for treatment of large cell lymphoma. But this treatment in general, the more intensive therapy, didn't win out in this realm.
And large cell lymphoma isn't just one disease either, right?
Yeah, that is true. So there are a number of different forms of large cell lymphomas. The most common is diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. That's the most common lymphoma in general. But there are T-cell lymphomas that can be large and aggressive. And so this trial was really limited to the large B-cell lymphomas. On the other end of the spectrum, there was a clinical trial looking at follicular lymphoma. And follicular lymphoma, again, is a very treatable treatable lymphoma disease with either chemotherapy or what we call immunotherapy. And so there's an immunotherapy that has been around for about 15 years and really is a mainstay of treatment for B-cell lymphomas. And this trial compared the immunotherapy that's been around for 15 years to a newer therapy. And in this clinical trial, the newer therapy did seem to improve outcomes. So it's likely that many lymphoma providers over the next years will be transitioning in some settings to this newer immunotherapy treatment.
So the newer therapy was also an immunotherapy?
It was, yes.
Uh-huh. And these immunotherapies, they're not oral, like some of what you were talking about, the newer, more exciting drugs.
Yeah, so the immunotherapy
still infusions, right?
Yeah, so the immunotherapies are still infusions, and they're typically given alongside chemotherapy. They augment the chemotherapy and also impact how our own immune system might recognize the lymphoma cells. And so it's an important component, but it also typically is given as an infusion either weekly sometimes and sometimes up to every month or 2 months.
Gotcha. But you said some of the new therapies are oral. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So there are a number of newer therapies that are actually currently in clinic and usually are used on a single agent basis. And so you may be on a therapy that you take every day that we hope will keep your lymphoma at bay for a long period of time, years potentially. What we're trying to figure out is whether combining therapies, much like for things like infectious diseases, where if we had a cocktail of treatment that were well tolerated, we might be able to improve outcomes. We're trying to find that cocktail for lymphoma and as well for these new oral agents.
Hmm. So if I were a patient with a diagnosis of lymphoma, whether it's a new lymphoma or a recurrent lymphoma, how would I even learn about whether there's any studies that I could go on if I wanted to? Because, you know, seems to me that I might want to know what's the latest and greatest or most promising and be part of that if I could.
Yeah, so there are a number of available websites. Leukemia and Lymphoma Society has a great website that has active clinical trials. You also can go on the Smilo Cancer website. We'll have clinical trials. I think as a lymphoma specialist, it's really important for patients to recognize that the diagnosis, being sure about the diagnosis, is the first step. Again, there's 60 different types of lymphomas. And you really need to have a hematopathologist, the doctors that look at your tissue, really to confirm what type of lymphoma is. That's the first step. The second step is going and basically being seen by a clinician that's comfortable in treating lymphomas. And so I think those are the two metrics on kind of starting your lymphoma process in terms of care, is making sure that the diagnosis is there. And number two is that your treating provider has knowledge about the treatment and also knowledge about ongoing clinical trials.
Yeah, and I guess from the numbers that you stated, if lymphomas are something like 5% of cancers or 8% of cancers, you know, many general oncologists might not see a lot of lymphoma.
That potentially is true. The more common lymphomas, diffuse large B-cell, follicular lymphoma, there are some moving pieces in terms of further subclassifying diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. But for the more rare diseases, a provider may only see a few of those every couple of years. And so I think we're recognizing that centers of excellence where patients are seen by providers that are lymphoma clinicians or hematopathologists that really focus on lymphoma are likely to be increasingly important as this world of personalized medicine really shifts how we think about lymphoma and treat lymphoma.
So it's certainly reasonable to consider a second opinion, even if you're very comfortable with your oncologist and your oncologist may be comfortable treating lymphoma in general. It wouldn't hurt to see a lymphoma expert to at least vet what's going on and make sure that everything is appropriate, right?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I also think that having a second opinion, but also receiving potentially treatment local, is important. So it's really important that providers and centers of excellence work together and collaborate to really make sure that the diagnosis is 100% sure, and also that the treatment really is on the right path. But it's frequent that patients can actually be treated locally under the guidance of their local oncologist.
Right. And I know that's something that we've worked here in the very carefully in the Yale Cancer Network to have our cancer center really be available in local sites from Torrington, you know, down to North Haven and now out to L&M Hospital, so that patients can get the same care essentially. Without having to come down to New Haven.
Yeah, no, I think that's worked quite well. So we have a weekly meeting where we discuss as clinicians and radiation oncologists and radiologists and pathologists. We come together and really discuss the cases that have some uncertainty. And we invite providers that are outside of the New Haven campus to call in and teleconference in. And so I think that's likely the way that we're going for the treatment of most cancers, is as we learn more about the cancer and further subclassify, we are likely to need experts that really focus on one disease process, but we have to recognize that we as a community, as a healthcare provider in the system, that we need to reach out to those providers that are actually on the front lines, that are actually doing the treatment, and really welcoming them into that process. And so I think I've been very happy. I've been here for about 2 years. I've been very happy with how the process is working in terms of the care centers and in terms of the multidisciplinary and collaboration that's been going on.
Now, you started sounding like somebody who thinks about ways that healthcare should be delivered in larger sense. I'm sensing there's another side of your interests that are not only just singularly disease-focused. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Yeah, sure. So I wear two hats. One is a lymphoma clinician, and the other really as a health services researcher. So I think about translating our clinical trials into really real-world care. So ensuring that patients, not only in academic centers, but really throughout the United States, have access to high-quality cancer care. And so that's really my research focus when I'm not in the clinic. When I'm not in the wards, I'm really focused on what's going on in the real-world practice of oncology and what sort of barriers might we be able to overcome to improve patient outcomes.
And how do you even measure that? I mean, do you make phone calls, focus groups? Groups, surveys. I mean, how do you figure out what's going on out there?
Yeah, so it really has many different methods of to really study this. And so sometimes it's just patient groups. So having patients come in and really be, what we call qualitative research, kind of learning their experience, because that can be really helpful. At the opposite end is actually doing big data research. So looking at things like insurance claims and in certain potential barriers to treatment or out-of-pocket costs. Those are the things that we actually do here in the Cancer Outcomes Group that I'm part of. That these are very large, large-scale insurance-based design clinical trials, or not clinical trials, but claims-based style trials.
So you've got the information about what insurance paid for individual patients, kind of thing, and so you see what's going on across the country like that. Is that what happens?
Yeah. So we can look at what provider a patient saw, or what health system a patient saw, and we can actually look at what care they received, and we can try to look at what are some of the characteristics that go into high quality care. And if we identify that, then our goal is really to disseminate kind of the special sauce to the other providers that are providing the high quality cancer care.
Dr. Scott Huntington is an assistant professor of medicine at Yale School of Medicine. If you have questions, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you'll also find past episodes in audio and written form. I'm Bruce Barber, reminding you to tune in every Sunday night to learn more about the progress being made in the fight against cancer here on WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.